Therefore, the impetus to maintain our anti-poverty programs did not decline. On the contrary, the impetus only increased. In fact, some people would argue, and there's controversy here, that the Green Revolution, at least in the initial phases, made the rich richer and the poor poorer. And this was an additional reason to maintain the tempo of anti-poverty programs. Now, the controversy on that last proposition mainly applies to the within successful states, that is within Punjab, within Haryana, within Western Uttar Pradesh, and so on. Now, within Western Uttar Pradesh might be a contradiction, but Uttar Pradesh can be broken down into 10 pieces and you will still have very large pieces left. Whereas nobody would deny that the Green Revolution had continued to increase disparities across the states. There's no denying this fact at all. So the momentum of anti-poverty programs continued. I now want to disaggregate in yet another fashion a growth performance by going into some details, namely looking a little bit at agriculture and industry. I'll have to do this in short order because I might be running out of time. I've got a full agenda here. By and large, agriculture shows no changes in the rates of growth, despite the Green Revolution. In fact, within 10, 15 years of the Green Revolution, some statisticians were trying to establish that agricultural growth rate had actually fallen after the Green Revolution. But now, with more years in the making, we can say that there was no acceleration, no deceleration, worth the name, in agricultural growth. But this does not mean, of course, that the Green Revolution made no contribution. Its contribution, rather, lay in the fact that agricultural yields started contributing a much larger part of total growth in agricultural output. Thus, for example, till 1965, yield contributed only 1%. The remaining 1.5% was contributed by area growth. But thereafter, that is, after the Green Revolution, the contribution of yield increased to 2%, or very nearly 80% of total agricultural growth was because of yield growth. Now, the disparities that I just mentioned across states was also felt across crops. For example, wheat by far was the most successful Green Revolution crop. Rice in some areas only. Cotton and sugarcane were the other success stories. By comparison, oil seeds, pulses, coarse grains were poor performers. And remember that these crops are produced in the less well-endowed regions of the country, particularly the Deccan region. The other region which performed very poorly, considering its potential for agriculture, was the eastern end of the Gangetic Plain, mainly Bihar, eastern UP, and Bengal. Now, what was the state's role in this relatively respectable performance of agriculture? Now, surprisingly enough, the state regulated agriculture very little. For one thing, it couldn't possibly regulate the actions of millions and millions of farmers, which it could do in the case of handfuls of industrialists. But nevertheless, the government played a very, very important facilitating role. This is something that we should bear in mind. It's unthinkable that Indian agriculture could have maintained the momentum that it maintained over the past 30 years, or indeed could continue to maintain any kind of momentum into the future without the state playing a continuing and important role. This is in respect of irrigation, in respect of agricultural research, in respect of extension, and in the provision of credit which would otherwise be unavailable. Bank nationalization had an very important impact on agricultural performance in this country. In fact, what I just said might remind some of you of the Asiatic state argument that has been entertained for a long, long time in many different kinds of writings. It is the proposition that unlike Occidental agriculture, Oriental, mainly Asiatic agricultures, were heavily dependent on large-scale irrigation works. And these large-scale irrigation works were by and large the works created by state authorities. But this then gave the foundation for the erection of oriental despotisms. It was the Mughal economy or the Chinese empire, et cetera, were founded on the so-called oriental despotisms. Now, this particular thesis is, I think, fairly without foundation, certainly in the Indian case. I don't wish to take up the case of Persia or China, for that matter. But in the Indian case, it is without solid foundation. But the fact still remains that there's an element of truth in it, and that element is the one that I just picked out, namely that the state has and will continue to play a very important, if not leading, role in agricultural development. One piece of evidence on this is that private investment in agriculture tends to track very closely public investment in agriculture, maybe with a small lag of 2-3 years. It's hard to imagine Punjabi farmers going around investing in stocks of fertilizer and tractors and farm implements and farm structures without the bakra. The incentive policies that government pursued also had a very important favorable effect for agriculture. But there's a big controversy here. As you know, by the late 80s, we were complaining about fertilizer subsidies, procurement policies, agricultural support prices, and so on and so forth. Now, these policies were launched more or less at the same time as the new agricultural strategy. The NAS was not just HYV, it was all of these policy adjuncts as well. Now, these policies have been controversial, for one thing, because they have by and large benefited farmers with surplus food. Secondly, they have been controversial because certainly in the good years, but possibly also along the trend over a long time, government procurement operations and agricultural pricing policies have prevented food prices from falling, as they ought to if productivity advances. Now, if productivity advances and food prices fall, this is good for industry. It's good for the poor. Why? Because the poor buy food. If the price of food falls, they benefit. Why is it good for industry? Because if the price falls, they need not pay as high a wage rate, and therefore profitability in industry improves, and therefore industrialists are happy. But when prices fall, because food is by and large a necessity, when supply increases, prices could fall precipitously. The end result could be that as a result of technological improvement, farmers end up getting worse off. Now, in part to prevent this worsening of the farmer's situation, I think the government has played a very, very active role in procurement operations. But one could argue that government has also slowed the engines of agricultural growth in order to prevent serious crises, political crises. Remember, in the late 70s and 80s, we have a huge Kishan movement on the rise in this country. One can hardly doubt that this was led and on behalf of the richer farmers in the richer states. And the explanation behind this is the growing insecurity that a market collapse might impoverish the better endowed regions. In fact, there is a regional dimension to this. Punjab develops first, and of course Punjabi farmers benefit. But the grain market nationally is one. The price of grain is essentially national. Now, if you develop Bihar and Bengal, let's say, or eastern Uttar Pradesh, what you're going to find is the farmers there are going to benefit because their output rises. But if their output rises, the national price is going to fall. What the Punjabi farmers then face are the backwash effects of that improvement. They will get worse off without seeing any additional new benefits coming in. Now, there is a very controversial proposition here, which I want to sort of raise. I have not looked at this very seriously. But I wouldn't be surprised at all that the Punjab crisis, now, you know, I hesitate to simplify matters, but the Punjab crisis has many origins, many dimensions. But the fact that Punjab was an early arriver on the agricultural growth scene, the fact that we have a unified grains market in this country, and the fact that regional disparities are very great, and the fact that public investment has to proceed from region to region. In other words, the fact that development is bound to be uneven means that given the low demand elasticity for agriculture, you're going to get all these tensions. You're going to get all these unevenness and therefore political tensions in the economy. It's possible that some of the Punjab problems are manifestations of hidden economic problems of this sort. Turning briefly to industry, I want to make a couple of remarks. Organized industry did the worst in the period of slowdown from 66 to 79. Unorganized industry was more resilient. And this is not surprising because organized industry was much more tied into the public investment. So if public investment slowed down, organized industry was the one which was likely to feel the brunt of it. On the other hand, government's small industry policy, at least in some respects, appeared to pay off, because in the 70s and thereafter, the small industrial sector, including the unorganized part of it, the small factories and the small workshops, have done pretty well. Employment in the small scale sector in industry has risen faster than employment in the organized sector, not only in the 80s. In the 80s, we all know that the organized sector experienced no increase in employment at all. But even in the 70s, the unorganized sector started growing faster in terms of employment than the organized sector. Which brings me to the question about the 80s and the genesis of the crisis. Now, what caused the faster growth in the 80s? Remember, in the 80s, growth recovers fully, and in fact, industry does very handsomely. I've already mentioned the comfortable stocks of food and foreign exchange and the high saving rate. These factors made the government bold, and the government stepped up the rate of public investment, which then had favorable impacts on the industrial economy. This was also the period when the government also stepped up anti-poverty programs, culminating in the Jawahar Rozgar Yojana. The result was a rise in the overall rate of growth, particularly led by consumer durables. But meanwhile, exports were not showing much increase, whereas imports continued to increase in order to feed the new growth phenomenon of the 80s. The result was a growing current account deficit. At about this time, when most of the rest of the world was drowning in debt, India was in an absolutely fantastic position along with China. We had a very low rate of external debt, ratio of external debt. So India was encouraged by policy advisors within and without to not hesitate to borrow abroad. And about 1981, 82, when the IMF loan comes in of $5 billion, and thereafter, the government continues to borrow. And the borrowing starts accelerating. Meanwhile, the government is under enormous fiscal pressure. The 80s was the subsidy raj, when every kind of subsidy ballooned, increased manifold. And this was also the period when hefty awards were given by the pay commissions. And the pay increases also hit the state and central budgets very hard. So for all of these reasons, government had a very powerful reason to borrow both at home and abroad. Now, it was not as if by as early as 86, 87, economists outside the government were not questioning the fiscal profligacy of the government, or for that matter, the external profligacy of the government. But the government's easy response always was, look, we are doing very well. Our economy is growing faster than ever before. Our inflation rate is under containment. And at any rate, we have a low borrowing ratio compared to, look at Mexico, look at Brazil, look at African countries, look at even South Korea. And we are in a very, very favorable position. So what's wrong in borrowing, especially when we are producing results, containing inflation and raising the growth rate? But from the second half of the 80s, this process of borrowing at home and abroad accelerated dramatically. The government's budget deficit went red at about this time. That is, current expenditures started exceeding systematically and by large margins current revenues. So the budget itself was in deficit on the current account. Meanwhile, the government, of course, wanted to maintain its public investment stance. This meant that the government's net borrowing requirement was galloping away. Part of this borrowing requirement was met from the market, but an increasing proportion was met by what is called printing money. Now, a word about printing money. Printing money, of course, literally means printing money. But exactly how does it happen? It happens through a fictitious transfer of paper between the government of India and the Reserve Bank of India. The government of India gives a piece of paper to RBI and says, I owe you 100 rupees. And the RBI gives the government of India 100 rupees, which is currency of the realm. It may be actual paper currency or it may be credits to GOI's account with the RBI. But either way, it's a transfer of paper which results in the government acquiring more purchasing power. And this sort of deficit financing, when it especially starts increasing, is potentially very disruptive because it could accelerate the rate of inflation. And that is precisely what happened in the late 80s. Now, the actual crisis, some people have argued, was exclusively because of the conjunctural factors of 1990 itself, namely the Iraq war and the sudden loss of confidence on the part of NRIs and other foreign lenders. I think this argument is valid only on its face. If you look deeper, I think you have to recognize that confidence becomes fragile only when there is reason to doubt the debtor's capacity. And this fragility of confidence came in the wake of a decade of reckless borrowing. And the reckless borrowing itself reflects sheer political irresponsibility. Now, there may be a seamy, very seamy side to this, which I would not normally mention in respectable company, but because I'm in the company of both respectable people and friends, let me venture it. It is the supposition that this irresponsibility may have been a kind of a desperate move to force the country into a situation where radical changes in policy would have to be initiated. Let us recall that in 1985-1986, Rajiv Gandhi, who wanted to usher India into the 21st century, ran into heavy weather within the Congress Party over his desire to move very quickly on market liberalization. So it is possible that there was a view within government that by putting the country in a fairly difficult position, the door would then be opened, the political door would then be opened to push through reforms which would otherwise not have been swallowed by the polity. I think there may be some truth to this, but whether there is truth to this hypothesis or not, by any reckoning, the economic policies of the 80s were politically irresponsible. Now, let me mention a few numbers on the external debt. Because this is also subject to some controversy and incorrect interpretations. Today, India is the fourth largest debtor in the world. Of course, the standard response to this is, look, you should not look at the debt. You should divide the debt by the GDP. Okay, let's do that. When you did that, India fell from rank 4 to rank 90. Not the worst debtor in the world. But you can do yet another thing, and that is divide the debt service obligations by our exports. When you did that, this ratio is 30%, and India moves up to the 19th rank in the world economy. Now, in other words, these three numbers give you very different pictures. I would suggest to you that the third number, rank 19, is really quite an important one, the most important one. I would also add that India has a relatively slender share of its total GNP in foreign trade. India is a relatively closed economy compared to virtually any third world country, with the possible exception of Burma. And therefore, the debt looms larger in terms of our exports, and therefore we are more vulnerable. So if somebody should suggest that we had not been profligate in our external borrowing policy, I think that person would be wrong in making that suggestion. Yes, if you looked at debt itself in absolute terms, it's running at about $75 billion today, which puts us at the fourth rank. Yeah. Yes, correct. Now, if you take the 19th rank seriously, as I think you ought to, because it's a 19th rank number which tells you how much you have to owe every year or every 6 months or every quarter and how much you have by way of export earnings out of which you can pay. So that is the real vulnerability index. Then that is already pretty high. We are 19th. But don't forget that the first 18 countries are out and out basket cases, many of them, including many in sub-Saharan Africa. We shouldn't feel comfortable about our 19th rank on the external debt servicing ratio. Now, the second point I made there was that India's is a relatively closed economy. Now, this means that our ability, either by sudden good fortune or by special effort, to move quickly on the export front is strictly limited. If you consider a more open economy such as Chile, which also had a debt problem, still has a debt problem, it has always been accustomed to exporting a very large share of its income abroad, of its GNP abroad. Therefore, its fortunes may turn adverse for a little while, but then it can wait a little bit and it's likely to brighten up again, because its markets will again be available into which it could export. That is not our story. I basically said that the government was under a lot of pressure to continue to spend for various sorts of things, public investment as well as current expenditure, including subsidies and anti-poverty programs. Since these expenditures were going beyond its means, it had to borrow. It could borrow at home or it could borrow abroad. At home, it could either borrow from the banking system, which is called market borrowing, or it could borrow from RBI, which is nothing but printing money. Increasingly, the government found that it was running into the limits of the banking system in terms of how much it could borrow. So it resorted increasingly to deficit financing, which is printing money. On the foreign front, the government had been initially encouraged to go ahead and borrow abroad because of our low indebtedness ratios. And the government started borrowing abroad. But as time went by, the pressures to borrow abroad continued to increase. In fact, after a while, our ability to get long-term loans from abroad dried up, in the face of which we resorted increasingly to short-term borrowings. So the average term of borrowing started declining in the second half of the 80s. And before we knew what, in 1990-91, we had a huge foreign debt, which had risen from $20-25 billion to $70-75 billion. In other words, it had increased threefold in the space of 10 years. I'm not sure if that answers your question. But we can take this up again in the discussion. I think it's useful also to note that in the early part of 1990, there was near euphoria, both at home and abroad. The euphoria was that India had turned the corner, or whatever the analogy might be, India was about to take off. In fact, the World Bank put out statements saying that India was about to join the ranks of the NICS. The NICS are the newly industrializing countries, countries such as Thailand, Malaysia, and Indonesia, which are 10 times as rich as us today in per capita nominal GNP terms. And surprisingly, within the space of a year, this euphoria turned to utter depression. It was clear that India was in a very bad situation. I don't have to go into the gory details. I'm sure you read the papers, you know what happened. But what's surprising is that the selfsame people who had been euphoric a year earlier now started saying that India had failed fundamentally. And India had always failed fundamentally. That the problems of 1991 could be dated back to 1947 or 1952 or 1956, as you please. And this is a really very strange Walt Fache. I mean, I don't have to tell you that. It's pretty obvious. So there is a significant ideological element in the turnarounds that many economists, many of our own economists, needless to say, many observers from abroad, underwent, when in fact they had praised the policies of the Rajiv era, they had praised the policies of the 80s, they had even said that, you know, Nirvana was around the corner, suddenly turning around and saying that India was in a very deep hole, and it was in a deep hole because it had dug it for itself. Now, the last point I want to raise is concerning the relative importance of fiscal profligacy versus import liberalization in causing our problems. Let me restate that. Import liberalization had taken place in the 80s, not nearly on the same scale as 91, 92, but had been increasingly liberalized. This, of course, meant that more imports would start flowing in. In 88-89, I had occasion to study HMT. I was looking at their industrial relations and spent some few weeks at their plants in Bangalore. And one of the constant complaints I heard from HMT managers, from the technologists all the way up to the marketing people, was that in the name of non-availability of domestic substitutes, all kinds of machine tools were being imported for car production, for example, even though HMT had surplus capacity. This is not a new story, but it's a story that we increasingly tend to hear lately. So import liberalization and laxity in enforcing our own policies had caused a sharp rise in imports. This was one cause. The other cause is fiscal profligacy. And how does that work? Well, when the government spends a lot on whatever it might spend, it gives rise to a boost in domestic demand, which means capacity utilization in various industries will increase because those industries will face demand in multiplier fashion. But when they find that they have to produce more, they also have to import more. So a rising fiscal deficit also drives, via the demand side, imports. So imports were rising on both accounts. And the question that I'm raising is, which was the more important factor? I think it would be fair to say that the fiscal drive was a more important factor. The explanation hinges on the fact that the fiscal increases of the 80s were far more dramatic than the extent of import liberalization that was in fact permitted. But they were both important, the one more so. The last point I want to make is to share with you a very simple calculation I made. What did we get in the 80s by becoming indebted? You know, if you go into debt and suddenly you find yourself in a very bad spot, I'm sure you would ask the question, why did I get into this situation? What did I get in return? Did I get something? Perhaps you got your daughter married off, for which you had to pay a dowry, and you borrowed. And you feel good about getting your daughter married off, which you might not otherwise have been able to do. So you had some pain and you had some gain, and you might still complain about the debt, but it's squared off. Let's do a simple calculation along the same lines for India. Between 1980 and 1991, foreign debt increased from, say, $25 billion to $75 billion, $50 billion. Now, the exchange rate has varied throughout, so I'll take 1985 as my reference here and apply the exchange rate of 15 rupees to the US dollar. 15 times 50 billion gives you, what is it? 750 billion, which is 750 billion is 75,000 crores, yes. Correct. So 75,000 crores. Now, if you take the same midpoint, 1985, our GNP in rupee terms was about 400,000 crores. Now, compared to the 70s, in the 80s, we got 2 extra percentage points of GNP growth. 2% extra. So over a 10-year period, that means we added 20% more to our national income than we would otherwise have been able to add. Now, 20% of 400,000 crores works out to 80,000 crores. So we have squared off those two numbers. Our improved GNP performance is roughly balanced by our increased foreign debt. Now, this may not make you feel very happy, because what it does is, it tells you that the growth gains of the 80s were somewhat illusory. But I think we can at least thank our stars that we were not in quite the same situation as what happened to many Latin countries. Because there, the people have asked and still continue to ask, where did all the money go? And you can't account for it very easily, because a lot of the money that came in from abroad to raise the foreign debt in Latin America went immediately back through a revolving door as capital flight. So that the rich of Latin America have stashed away billions, hundreds of billions, in foreign banks, and every man, woman, and child in Latin America is now owing $1,000, $1,500, $2,000, $4,000 abroad. This money has to come off of their backs. We can at least say we didn't do quite as badly as that. We exactly squared off the costs of increased debt with the benefits of increased growth. I'll stop there. Dealing with the rest of the material that I had planned to deal with, I should do some reorganization. And this is what I'm proposing to do. I'll spend a little while at the beginning of today's session talking about the reforms, particularly stabilization, and some of the structural adjustment measures that have actually been undertaken by the government. And then essentially leave that issue hanging there and turn to the question of liberalization in general. What is the theory of liberalization? I mean, what is it supposed to mean? What is it supposed to contribute to the economy, to meeting the needs of the people, and so on and so forth? I'll consider a number of arguments in favor of liberalization, and also take up a number of arguments which throw doubt at the least, and possibly reject some of those arguments for liberalization. And also make some brief mention as far as the experience of developing countries at the current conjuncture is concerned. Finally, and if I have the time for it, I'll come back to the issue that I left hanging and make some evaluative comments about the Indian program itself. So that's as far as today's lecture is concerned. Now, as far as tomorrow is concerned, I thought I should spend no more than about 30 minutes talking about alternatives. Are there alternatives? What are the alternatives? And here my focus is going to be on the basic needs of the population at large, not the 10% or the 150 million of the so-called middle class that we hear a great deal about, but of the population at large. Are there ways of bringing the needs of the people at large into consistency with the aspirations of the middle class? Or are there contradictions there? And indeed also raise the question whether the direct approach to solving the problems of the larger population might take more time and more resources, in fact, than the shortcut approach of trickle-down via rapid growth, building on the middle class itself. And I will lay out a few items for the agenda so that we have a structured discussion, but thereafter it'll be a free-for-all. I'm hoping that people will join in and participate and subscribe and discuss and thrash some of the issues out at least. Okay, now there was an issue that I ended yesterday's talk with, and that was debt and dowry. Somehow I managed to connect those two, and there are two misimpressions that I may have left in the minds of some of you which I would like to correct. First, I argued that simple calculations suggest that the extra growth of the 80s is more or less cancelled off by the extra debt that we incurred during the 80s. And I also suggested, by way of analogy, that a debt incurred by a family to get the daughter married off, to pay the dowry, can be viewed similarly as some pain obtained in exchange for some gain. On both of these issues, I would like to make corrections, because both of these statements leave the impression that therefore the debt was not a problem, that therefore the dowry is not a problem. I do not imply either of those. I do not approve the dowry system. I think it's a ghastly system. We should get rid of it if we can. Nor do I approve of the responsible behavior that produced the debt. In the case of the debt, it's obvious that even if we squared off the costs of the debt immediately incurred in the 80s with the benefits, we know that by 1991, the debt overhang caused a tremendous amount of pain. The pain has not vanished yet. What is more, it's going to mean a lot more adjustments in the coming decade or so. So it would be wrong, I think, to look at only the flow benefits, the current flow benefits and the current flow cost, and strike the balance and say that's that. All right? So I wanted to bring to your attention those two corrections. The first question, as far as the reforms are concerned, the reforms that were initiated in 91, is of course whether they were externally inspired. In particular, whether they were inspired by the IMF. Now, at one level, this is a ridiculous question because the IMF has never given money without conditionalities. The IMF has always imposed conditions. And these conditions are often very specific. In fact, there is a programming model that the IMF always uses. And when the country comes up to borrow money, the IMF puts the country's numbers through that programming model and comes up with a standard set of recommendations. So in that sense, going to the fund implied accepting the conditions. And these conditions specifically relate to devaluation, target reductions in the public deficit, and tariff reforms. Now, in the ordinary course, many more other conditions would be imposed. There are two factors that should be taken into account here. First of all, India is not quite a bit player in the international political economy. India can't be played around with the same way SSA countries could be. The SSA stands for Sub-Saharan Africa. The second consideration is how much of the fund's potential conditionalities have already been internalized by the country in question. I think both of these factors work jointly to reduce the apparent conditionalities that the IMF imposed. Now, the question to ask is, did we have any choice about going to the IMF or not going to the IMF? I think any existentialist will tell you that you always have a choice. But that is not very helpful because in this particular instance, I do not believe we had a meaningful choice. To have chosen not to go to the IMF would have meant long lines at the gas stations, would have meant rationing of edible oils, would have meant a steep fall in GNP, would have meant significant inflation. In short, what I'm saying is none of us, I assume, is so concerned about our national sovereignty and national dignity, et cetera, as to put such a high premium on it and then impose such a high cost on the population at large. So in that sense, I believe we exercise the right choice. But the same thing can be viewed another way, and we can say that we did not have a meaningful choice at all. But as an aside, I want to note that the proper thing to have done would have been to go to the IMF in 88, in 89, in 90, before waiting for all hell to break loose. So in that sense, the right choices had not been exercised when the time was right. And that's why we were caught up in a trap, in a very bad trap. The second point that I would like to make in this connection about the IMF's arm twisting role is something that I've mentioned before, which is that starting from the late 70s and throughout the 80s, a body of opinion had developed in this country. And strangely enough, most of this opinion had built up within the government in the form of various reports from various commissions, which essentially favored major surgery on the control system in India relating to the organized sector and favored paving the way for a liberal regime. In fact, some of the measures had already been taken. The exchange rate was on a crawling peg throughout the 80s. Devaluation was occurring slowly rather than in one fell swoop. We had removed many restrictions on imports. And we had also allowed some liberalization in our licensing system. So in this view, the crisis merely precipitated larger scale action on the path that had already been accepted by official opinion throughout the 80s. It seems to me that 91 should be remembered at least as much as a political watershed as an economic watershed. It's more of a political watershed because the economic crisis provided, it seems to me, the political conditions to carry through drastic reforms which otherwise might not have been permitted by our polity. But having said all of this, which in a sense is a kind of backhanded approval of the 91 reforms, I'll come to the details of it, what is approvable and what is questionable and so on. we should nonetheless remember that in 91 we were in a very weak position. And while a weak economic position is conducive to taking strong political action, at least some of the time, a weak economic position is not always the best time to take strong economic action, strong economic reforms. So that handicap is something that we've had to live with. Now, what is this reform? In the standard jargon, we divide reforms into two parts, stabilization and structural adjustment. And let me define these two terms. Stabilization simply means putting your accounts in order. Basically, it means cutting down national expenditure to set the balance of payments in order. Secondly, it means cutting down government expenditure to put the fiscal deficit in order. So putting both the national and the government financial houses in order is what stabilization amounts to. How you can do it, we can, there are various options and we'll consider some. Structural adjustment, on the other hand, is a more amorphous term. It refers to anything and everything that you might possibly do, both at the macro level and at the micro level, at the level of particular sectors, enterprises, and so on, to create the conditions for renewed growth when growth has already faltered. Right? So structural adjustment, in a sense, is long-term reform. Reform that is oriented towards producing benefits in the long term. Stabilization is reform to just stabilize the ship. Even though in theory you can structurally adjust an economy in a variety of ways. In practice, these terms have come to mean very specific things. And the reason why this has happened is because more stabilization and more structural adjustment, and I include the East European cases when I say this, have come under the aegis of the fund. This is what gives substantial unity and specificity to the meaning of stabilization and structural adjustment in the present context. And what does that in fact mean? In practice, under the fund, stabilization has come to mean market-oriented reforms on the external front as well as the internal front. It has come to mean getting the state out. It has come to mean a minimalist role for the state. It has come to mean getting the prices right, which is to say getting rid of all kinds of subsidies and all kinds of unnecessary taxes. In short, it is not far off the mark to say that stabilization and structural adjustment under fund auspices amounts to establishing a liberal economy. And I use the word liberal in the precise 19th century sense. Practically approaching laissez-faire. This is the statement one could make at the broadest level. Just in case you thought this is too far-fetched in the world in which we live, I can assure you there have been cases where near laissez-faire has been brought about with disastrous consequences. The Southern Cone countries of Latin America come to mind, late 70s, early 80s, Argentina and Chile in particular, Uruguay as well. Now, where does the Indian case stand in relation to this unified notion of stabilization and structural adjustment? I think you will agree with me that the broad thrust of our reforms since 91 are in the same direction as I've just stated to be the fund position. But that is not the same thing as saying that we have finished the business. We have launched along the path. We have not gone very far. We have gone some significant distance. Let's say if I had to put a number on it, I would say we have gone 50% of the distance. But we have still another 50% to go. So what have we done? First of all, before I actually say what we have done, I want to emphasize something which many people have remarked about. And that is, in the Indian case, stabilization policies and structural adjustment policies have formed a seamless whole. You cannot sort of cut it up and say this is the stabilization part of the package and this is the structural adjustment part of the package. They've come as an inseparable whole. My evaluation of it partly hinges on that fact. But before I get to that, let me talk about what we've done. First of all, we have had fiscal cuts. A government which wishes to invest 7.5% of GDP, but manages to generate no more than 2.5%, or 1%, or 0%, or minus percent, by way of a surplus for itself, has to ask itself the question whether it can continue to sustain the 7.5% of GDP investment that it wants to, that it wishes to. And the answer became clear that it could not. And something had to give. And remarkably enough, current expenditures have given much less than has public investment in our country. But this is not a unique story. Throughout the world, expenditures have to be cut. Typically, governments respond by cutting investment, because governments have short time horizons. Investments have long period payoffs. Current expenditures generally tend to get rescued, at least in relative terms. So we have controlled, we have cut our expenditures. There have been some defense cuts. There has been some reduction in subsidies, particularly in the area of fertilizers. There has been some retrenchment in the public enterprises. And there has at least been noise that we should bring down the losses of our state electricity boards and our state road transport corporations. These two sets of behemoths contribute a great deal of our total public deficit. Now, some of this has yet to come. And a lot of this cutting is supposed to come from price reform. It's supposed to come not just from cutting costs and making the irrelevant enterprises, departments, corporations more efficient, but also by raising prices and raising rates. Now, note here that you can raise prices and therefore you can balance the budget. But when you raise important prices, like the price of energy or the price of irrigation water, these are likely to feed through the economic system and produce inflation. And when that cost push inflation shows up, workers, at least those that can defend their own interests, are not going to take it lying down. They're going to push up their nominal wage rates. When they do that, employers in general, but government in particular, is once again going to be back where it started. Because it's cutting its deficit by raising the price of its services, but it ends up indirectly raising the wage rates of its own employees. That sort of a vicious circle could only lead to inflation. Inflation is, for the most part, nothing but a word which denotes social conflict which has been pushed under the rug. That is what inflation is. Inflation is what comes about when nobody wants to handle the hot potato. And everybody passes the hot potato around. And the end result is everybody's fingers are a little bit hotter or burnt. That's what inflation is. And here's an example of how that could develop. In other words, the path of public pricing reforms is very important. We need it. The LPG price increase, which happened yesterday, and which the opposition has criticized, ought to happen. We need many more such price reforms, because there are far too many subsidies, which in fact end up going to the rich in this country, which don't deserve to be there, and which are to a significant extent responsible for the mess that we are in. But it's not easy to get out of the mess. That's the point I'm making. When you release the prices, you're likely to release the inflation genie. And in a poor country like ours, you don't need a very high rate of inflation to produce a lot of distress and potential political instability. I'm sure some of you often wonder how Latin American countries can sustain the sorts of inflation rates that they sustain. 1,000% per annum, that's 100% increase in the price every month, every month. Imagine the rate at which the menu cards must be changing, and it must be reprinted and so on. But those are economies where the bulk of economic agents, including workers, including peasants, have mechanisms to defend their real incomes. So that if you want eventually to bury the hot potato, you need a very high rate of inflation to impose some cost on somebody. Eventually, a very high rate of inflation can accomplish that, because it all depends on the complex formulas for inflation, the frequency of indexation, the extent of indexation, and so on and so forth. So in those economies, when you want to balance the national and the government budgets, balancing acts produce inflation, but those rates of inflation are very high in order to produce small, effective balances. But in our country, the inflation rate doesn't have to be very high to produce significant balancing. But by the same token, even an 8% rate of inflation or a 12% rate of inflation is very costly, socially very costly. And that is why the Indian economy has always had a hypersensitivity to the inflation rate. This simply means that our economy has very large numbers of poor and vulnerable people, and no government can afford to impose the costs on those people without limit. The second thing that we have done is on the balance of payments front. Here, of course, we devalued the Indian rupee. The devaluation was a one-shot affair, but the Indian rupee has been depreciating for quite some time now, steadily, slowly, almost invisibly. Now, what is this devaluation supposed to do for us? What the devaluation does is that it makes imports more expensive than before. Therefore, it serves as a disincentive for people to import. At the same time, it fetches higher revenues for a given dollar value of exports. Therefore, it provides an extra incentive for exporters to export. If this policy were to work as the textbooks claim it is supposed to work, then you will find pretty soon imports turning down, exports turning up, and the gap decreasing, and the balance of payments getting balanced. Now, in practice, this is a very iffy proposition. There are two reasons for this. One is that imports may come down somewhat in the initial period, but not by very much. Exports may increase somewhat in the short period, but not by very much. In fact, the export response usually takes quite a while. It may take 3 years, it may take 4 years, 5 years, but certainly not the first 2 years, 3 years, normally. And if the imports are necessities rather than luxuries or discretionary goods, and nobody can deny that by and large our imports have been in the first category, that is necessities, then there's very little you can do to cut those imports. The only way you can cut those imports is to cut activity levels. That is, you have to shut down some factories, work two shifts instead of three shifts and so on. Then you can reduce your oil imports. Then you can reduce your fertilizer imports and so on. But that would be very expensive. So in practice, devaluation is bitter medicine, which takes quite a long time to take effect. Now, the other thing that we have done is that in phases we have gotten current account convertibility. Current account convertibility simply means if you export, then you get to convert the foreign exchange earnings and you get the rupees at the market rate. If you import, you buy the necessary foreign exchange and you pay for the import. That's what current account convertibility means. Now, current account convertibility does not mean that you can import anything you like and export anything you like. Try to export officially opium. You cannot. Try to import Jaguar cars freely. you cannot. So we have import restrictions, export restrictions, but within the framework of those restrictions, we have current account convertibility, which is different from what we had before, which is that the exchange rate was regulated and you were not guaranteed those earnings. And the Export Act was separate from the Import Act. If you exported, you earned the revenue, but the foreign exchange went to the RBI. If you imported, you had to get the permission from RBI to acquire the quota of foreign exchange that you needed. Now, current account convertibility is not the same thing as convertibility in general, because there's another account on the balance of payments called the capital account. On the capital account, all long-term debt and investment transactions take place. Suppose, for example, I have an ancestral house in India, but I live in the US and I want that money. Then that would be a capital account transaction. I would have to sell the house, acquire the rupees, convert it into dollars and ship it abroad. But there's no way you'll get permission to do that as of today. Or you might want to invest abroad, and so on and so forth. Now, capital account convertibility is supposed to be on the cards, but it's not a reality as of today. The third thing we have done is to greatly liberalize, free up the import of capital goods, materials, and technologies. And at the same time, to free up the conditions under which foreign capital can be invested in this country. Now, I sort of phrased this set of reforms in almost one sentence, but it's a crucial area of reforms. This is the element which potentially globalizes the economy. A word about this term globalization. The world has been globalizing for a very long time, since at least 1492, when Columbus went to America. So what's special about this? What's special is that in the late 70s and throughout the 80s, financial markets became much more integrated. This has in part something to do with the new information technologies, whereby lots of money can be transacted across long distances at lightning speed. It also has to do with the fact that the stock of international investments has increased quite a bit. International real investments. Thus, for example, Japanese have invested a lot in the US, the US has invested a lot in Japan or in Europe and so on. So cross-country investments have increased tremendously. And the increase in real investment will necessarily occasion the increase in financial transactions. So the market, which has truly become very globalized today, is the financial market. On the real side, we know that globalization is not yet a reality in any thorough sense. Were it so, then we would not have needed the GATT negotiations that we had, because the GATT was trying to globalize trade a little bit more, but there was resistance. The whole area of international trade and services has been put off, for example. So globalization of trade is not something that has gone nearly as far as the globalization of finance. But the point that I wanted to make there was that we have significantly freed up the import of capital goods, materials, technologies, and most important of all, direct foreign investment. Now, the reason why we have taken all of these measures, or I should add the most important of them all, tariff reductions, the most obvious and the most important. We have reduced our maximal tariff rates very steeply, and we have made further promises under GATT to reduce those rates very much more further. So our tariffs have come down very significantly, and we have all but eliminated quotas or quantitative restrictions on imports of various kinds of goods. Now, all of these are meant to put the national house, national financial house in order, the balance of payments. The third area that we have done something is in the area of market, promoting market competitiveness. by and large, this is summarized by the freeing up of licensing, MRTP, and other kinds of restrictions on the free mobility of capital inside the economy. You want to expand, you may do so. You want to diversify, you may do so. But you cannot very easily dismantle. We do not have, as yet, a free market exit policy. Companies that fall sick can still be taken over, and chances are that they will still be taken over. They may be referred to BIFR, which is just a way of putting the decision off to taking them over in many cases. Not in all cases, in many cases. But nonetheless, these moves of domestic reform, licensing in particular, amount to freeing up private capital mobility inside the economy. Now, this is supposed to produce more competition. Fair enough. But competition is also supposed to improve economic growth. So the rationale for domestic sector reforms is to improve the rate of economic growth. I'll come back to this proposition. It's a very important one and a very doubtful one, very doubtful one. Market competitiveness is also supposed to come about from the freeing up on the external side, which I've already discussed. Why? Because that you open the windows, the outside competitors come in, and your local chaps are supposed to get their acts together, become more efficient, less lazy, and all the other good things. The fourth thing that we have talked about is the human face. It's a phrase which comes from the UNICEF after a book that they brought out called Adjustment with a Human Face. And this really amounts to either programs or promises to take care of the weak and the vulnerable. Provision of safety nets, continuation or strengthening of anti-poverty programs, continuation of the public distribution system, of the employment programs in rural areas, and so on and so forth, and add to all of that the National Renewal Fund, which primarily is supposed to cushion organized sector workers' losses by providing them compensation, by providing them retraining, by providing them placement facilities, and so on and so forth. So that's what we have done so far. And the unfinished agenda is still very large. Financial reform. Financial reform is at the early stages as of now. Capital adequacy norms have been imposed on our banking system following the Basel Convention. That is, you require our banks to have sufficient own capital. In this case, because they're nationalized banks, this is capital from the government of India itself. Sufficient own capital relative to the total amount of loans outstanding and various other formulas. This is supposed to protect the bank against potential failure. Why? Because the bank can, under certain circumstances, acquire a lot of bad debt, which means it has acquired a lot more liabilities than it might be safely able to handle. In which case, the capital that the bank owns will have to come in as a shield. We have also reduced the statutory liquidity ratio for our banks. What this means is, thus far, and India is not an exception, the government of India has required our banks to hold a certain fraction of their total money in the form of government securities. Of course, if they hold a total fraction of their money in the form of government securities, the other side of the balance sheet is that the government gets that money. The government has preempted a large fraction of our banking system's resources through these statutory liquidity requirements. And those are being reduced. They have been reduced, and they will be reduced a great deal more. Why? The idea is to create a level playing field between the state and the private sector. The state may invest, the private sector may invest, but they better borrow on the marketplace. And they better borrow on equal terms. Or if the one is stronger than the other, they will get unequal terms. But those unequal terms will not be statutorily dictated. We have made very little headway, as I've already mentioned before, on exit policy. We have made some headway on privatization of public enterprises. But here, the motives are mixed. And when motives are mixed, and an outside observer cannot really fathom exactly what the mix of motives is. One motive is to raise money for the government. You sell an enterprise, you get the money, and you finance your health program, for example. Or you finance your defense expenditures. The other motive is the liberal motive, which is based on the assumption that if you can minimize the role of the state, you will end up maximizing economic efficiency. Both motives are, in fact, implicated in the current context. Now, how far this will go is anybody's guess. The first round of privatization has already come in for a lot of criticism, in part because there was a there was a stink in it. And privatizations have not been very successful everywhere. Britain, under Thatcher, launched a series of privatizations. Some of them, such as the privatization of water supply in towns and cities, fell flat on its face. But despite this experience, the bank and the fund keep telling poor countries with much less organizational and administrative capabilities, and with an even less willing private sector, to privatize sanitation in the cities, to privatize water supply in the cities, and so on. So it seems to me that the government has a very long distance yet to go, and this distance will not be traveled very easily, in part because we haven't yet seen the fruits of the first half of the path that we have traveled so far. But I'll come back to this set of concerns. I've not yet really gone into the valuation of these reform efforts. I now want to take up the theory of liberalization. Now, if you looked around, if you picked up a financial newspaper, for example, or if you read the Sunday columns, you would get the impression that the world is unifying. There's globalization. The world is also unifying because the East Bloc has disappeared. Socialism has vanished, practically speaking, from the face of the earth. You find that numerous countries, with or without debt, have been turning liberal, have been privatizing, have been marketizing, have been trying to get their prices right, and so on. You get the impression, in other words, that liberalism has caught a second wind, and a powerful one at that. Now, some of this is real. Some of this is illusory. Some of this is really illusory. After all, for a long time, people have insisted on distinguishing the United States from the USSR as economic systems. But there are quite a few similarities. To take up just one, the military-industrial complex in both these economies. To take up another, the share of public expenditure and national income is pretty high, even in the so-called private economies. If you take the Scandinavian economies, they approach 55-60%. These are semi-socialist economies. The public domain rivals, even in many cases, larger than the private domain of economic activities. So some of this is illusory, some of this is real. Now, in order to understand the logic of liberalization, I think it's useful to consider a few concepts, which I think might be useful. They are not terribly difficult concepts, but might be useful to you. So I thought I should lay them out. I'm sure all of us have heard the word economic efficiency. Now, we would like to know what this means. If you talk to a power engineer what he means by efficiency, he'll immediately tell you what it is. It is the output-input ratio. It's a physical number. Economic efficiency is not that at all. Economists do not address technological problems. They assume that the economy is run efficiently by the engineers, by the technologists, by the managers, and so on. Rather, what they mean by efficiency is producing the right mix of bridges and dams. Whether the bridge should be built this way or that way, is it being efficiently built, is not the economist's concern. That's the engineer's concern. The same would be true of the dam. But how many bridges should we have? How many dams should we have? That is the economic question. So this is the issue of allocation. And by efficiency, usually economists mean allocative efficiency. That is, producing the right mix of goods which satisfies the consumers to the maximum possible extent. Now, you go to a shop, you're looking for shoes, and you find no shoes but plentiful shirts. That would be a case of misallocation. And you'll come back frustrated, of course. But the frustration may be less obvious. In other cases of misallocation, the price of shoes might be rather high compared to what it could be, and the price of shirts might be rather low compared to what it might be. And if you change the mix of shoes and shirts, you might end up making the consumer feeling better off. So that would also be a case of inefficiency. There's another kind of allocative inefficiency, and that is the development of bottlenecks. You create 25 new schools, and you find that there are no trained teachers because you forgot to train the teachers. That's an example of allocative inefficiency as well, but really doesn't fit into the normal notion of the economist's notion of efficiency. And these bottlenecks have been very important in India. This morning we faced a bottleneck. The power failed. That's an example of a bottleneck. The second issue of importance is utilization of resources. The first way in which utilization may suffer is when you simply waste resources. You print too many school books, your classrooms are there, your teachers are there, but there are too many school books for anybody to find any good use for it. But there's another way in which malutilization may come about, and that is when there is no effective demand for what you have produced. You have your classrooms, you have your teachers, you have the books, but the students don't want to come to school. The dropout rate is high. So utilization is a second area of concern. The third area of concern is mobilization. You want to finance new investments when you want to get growth going, which means you have to mobilize resources for the purpose. But this is only one type of resource that one could talk about, financial resources. The other kind of resource is human resources. You need to produce the right kinds of skills, the right kinds of people to take up the activities that you want to pursue. Finally, there is the notion of development or growth. How does growth come about? If you think about it, growth can only mean two things. Economic growth, I mean, can only mean two things. One is, whatever you are producing, you produce at lower cost. Second, you produce new things. So new products and cost reductions are the heart of growth. That's what growth is almost all about. Now, with these concepts, let's proceed to sort of look at the world at large, the third world at large, and try to understand what's been happening. Now, the elements of convergence that are becoming clear by the early 90s are as follows. Through most of the third world, you'll find that the public sector has taken big hits. There have been big cuts. That, in particular, public investment has suffered the most in third world countries. Second, in most of these countries, trade liberalization has been very common. Tariff rate reductions, elimination of quotas, and so on. Third, throughout the third world, there has been a decline in labor utilization. That is to say, there has been an increase in unemployment or underemployment. At the same time, in many third world countries, there has developed an employment overhang. An employment overhang exists when there are people who are employed but who are not busy. They're employed, but they're not producing anything. This is notable in the public sector, but it is not absent in the private sector at all. So throughout the world, there is an employment overhang, even as employment is falling outside in the marketplace. Fourth, firms in third world countries are not having a good time at all. Firms are under threat of survival. They're looking for ways for reducing their costs. They're looking for ways to become more flexible. And in many cases, they have resorted to new types of employment relations which perhaps they were not familiar with before. Perhaps they would not easily take up those types of relationships before. I have in mind casualization and subcontracting. The organized sector at the fringes is now merging with the unorganized sector. You might formerly be working for Hindustan Lever, let's say, but you might be no different from a chap working at the corner of the street as an assistant to a panwala. Because at the fringes of the organized sector, employment relations have been changing in favor of casualization. Finally, there appears to be a modernization overhang throughout the third world. People have come to the conclusion that a lot of the existing plant is outdated, requires modernization, requires heavy investment, requires automation in many cases. And that in this discussion, the main consideration is not the needs of the country involved, is not the economics even of the country involved, except in the sense of achieving competitiveness in the world market. For example, without expressing an opinion on this matter, one has to wonder why computerize our banks. Now, of course, all of you, including myself, are bank customers, and we know that computerization will be a wonderful thing. We'll get better service. But at what cost? At what cost? Unless you look at the economics of it carefully, unless you put a value on the better services, unless you put a value on the investment that you have to make, unless you value out the labor that's involved, you do not reach a conclusion about computerization. Again, I'm not saying that computerization is a bad thing, but in many instances, automation and getting the latest appears to be almost a rule of thumb that many people assume that getting what's available out there at the frontier is the right thing to do, even without much investigation. So that's the set of changes that has been taking place in the third world. Why? In other words, if there is some kind of convergence in the world economy that's going on, and I believe there is, and I don't want to minimize the differences, but nonetheless there is some convergence, why is there a convergence? I think there are two sets of factors, one ideological, one real. First, the ideological factors. One, I've already mentioned, the overwhelming influence of the fund and the bank. And the fact that many third world countries got into debt. Now, the issue of apportioning the blame for getting into debt is a complex one, as I pointed out last time. But all concerned appear to be responsible. The country's governments have borrowed recklessly. They've been irresponsible. The rich, typically, of these countries have used all of these borrowings to put their money abroad. A lot of this borrowing has financed capital flight. Third, there is also the loan pushing argument. In 1973, there was the oil price hike, which resulted in a huge transfer of purchasing power from the rich countries, especially, but also from the third world, to the OPEC. The OPEC didn't know what to do with this money, so they shipped it back to the European and the American banks. The European and the American banks themselves did not know what to do with the money, because there was only so much investment that was going on. So they wanted to push the money onto borrowers. So this is the loan pushing argument. Holding the international banking system liable significantly for the debt crisis that eventuated. But I think all of these factors were important. And this is one root of the convergence that I just discussed. Second, the fall of the planned economies. The fall of the planned economies has had two effects. One, which is real and relevant, and that is that a lot of us who were earlier believers in planning have come to realize the limits of planning. A lot of us have come to realize the value of decentralization. The other is somewhat illusory. The end of the Cold War and the chest thumping that liberals engaged in ever since then has resulted in less space being available for alternative ideologies, alternative worldviews, alternative ways of thinking about organizing societies and economies. Liberalism has simply pushed other ideologies out because of the decline of the Soviet system. Third, in some cases, the ideological challenge has not come from outside at all, but from inside. I cannot imagine that the Chinese reforms of 78 were engineered from abroad. They were the result of huge struggles going on inside Chinese society. Nor will I ignore, nor should we ignore, the internal political considerations which were clearly important in our own experience of the past 3 years. There are significant groups of people in our society who are convinced that we are finally on the right path as a society and as an economy. And the political changes, the policy changes, may be reflexive of the political influence of the people who think now we are on the right track. So domestic political factors having an ideological influence on policy. That brings me to the real factor that may be causing convergence. This is an old argument. Many decades ago, a Russian economist named Kondratiev discovered that capitalist economies have two types of cycles. One type of cycle that we have known for long, long, long time, and that is a business cycle. This lasts for about 10 years. There's an upswing, and then there's a downswing. Then there's an upswing, then there's a downswing every 10 years. The Kondratiev cycle, on the other hand, is a 50-year cycle. It's 25 years of long period growth, and then 25 years of decline. If not decline, at least stagnation. In the post-1950 period, this is obvious. In fact, people have called the 1950-1973 period the golden age of capitalism. And a golden age it surely was. It produced the highest rate of growth that mankind has ever known on a very large scale. But since 1973, the world economy is in trouble, has been in trouble for a long time. Recession, stagflation, inflation, debt crisis, potential trade wars, etc., etc. And the advanced economies are still not on a sound footing. They still do not know where they should be heading. They still have low rates of productivity growth, half or one-third the rates of productivity growth that they had in the first 25 years after 1950. Now, why are these Kondratiev cycles? Why are there these Kondratiev cycles? By the way, these cycles can be documented for a much longer period, going before 1950. That's a complex issue. One reason is could be technological. There's some key technology that comes on the scene, and its spread is so vital, it is such a basic technology, that it revolutionized major parts of the economy. The railways and the internal combustion engine have been correlated with the respective Kondratiev upswings of their periods. But the other explanation is social. Capitalism is not one thing. If you want proof for this, just compare Japan with the United States. It's not one thing. It's many different types of capitalism. There are many different kinds of institutions. And in particular, the relationship, the social relationships between key actors are what distinguish one capitalism from another. The relationship between state and capital. In the United States, largely antagonistic or indifferent, except in the military-industrial complex. In Japan, cooperative. The relationship between capital and labor. In the United States, we'll give you money, you do us work. In Japan, we will cooperate to continuously improve technology and products and so on. The relationship among enterprises. In Japan, by and large, There are cooperative networks. Now, I don't want to push this argument too far because you'll probably assault me with the question that maybe Japan is not capitalist at all after all. You know, if there is so much cooperation, very little competition, what's capitalist about Japan? But you know, you can go along these lines and discover significant differences between different types of capitalism. Now, this does not mean that one type of capitalism remains sound and adequate for all time. It appears to have vigor and a vitality initially, then it appears to exhaust itself. As it exhausts itself, you enter the Kondratiev downswing. As it shows its vigor, you are up the Kondratiev cycle. And this has been argued by eminent economic historians, the correlations and so on. But those are the reasons. The point that I'm making is that so long as we have these long cycles, we can expect debt crises. The debt crisis of 1990 was not the first crisis, or 82 was not the first crisis. In the 19th century, we had debt crises. The difference was that in the 1990s, you did not have an IMF, but you had gunboats. British gunboats came to Argentina to enforce payment of what Argentina owed Britain. We have had a debt crisis throughout the past 200 years. We have had depressions and upswings. We have had technology cycles. So what is different about this one? Is there any difference? There is a difference, at least as far as the third world is concerned. In the past cycles, long cycles, we typically found that the late entrants managed to get out of their backwardness. They managed to develop. Up and down the cycle, but they managed to develop. But in the post-50 period, very few have managed to develop. The East Asian countries, and lately the Southeast Asian countries, but the vast majority of developing countries have not developed that successfully. In fact, the debt crisis, the external problems, etc., are symptomatic of failure of growth. I also mentioned yesterday that if you looked at the import tariff proportion of imports, this has risen steadily from a low number of 20% in 65 to 55% in 1990 for India. That story is repeated in many parts of the world. Competitiveness has declined. Why is this? I think the difference is that you do not have a level playing field in the world. You have some really strong players in technology, the advanced countries, and you have some really weak players throughout the world. And the pace of technological development has become faster because technological development has become institutionalized. Incidentally, you will note that the downswing starting in 1975, which we have still which we are still living through, coincides with a very major technological innovation. That is the chip. The chip is revolutionizing all kinds of technologies throughout the world, but it's not producing great benefits as yet for humanity. So this may be a bit of an exception, but this suggests to me that in an unequal world with very unequal playing conditions, perhaps we have reached the stage where it has become even more difficult than it used to be to join the ranks of the rich. The incline has become steeper. And this may be in, and